Good afternoon and welcome to this webcast introducing the new lease accounting standard, IFRS 16, which has been published today by the IASB. I'm Petrina Buchanan and I'm joined today by my colleagues Catherine Donkersley and Roberta Ravelli. Before we get into the webcast, just a few words on the information that you can find on the IASB's website today regarding IFRS 16. First of all, IFRS 16 itself is available for eIFRS subscribers. In addition, on our website and available to all, is firstly a project summary and feedback statement. This document discusses the requirements of IFRS 16 at a high level and explains how the IASB has responded to the most significant feedback received throughout the project. Secondly, you'll find an effects analysis, which discusses the likely costs and benefits of IFRS 16, and also, for example, includes quite some detail on the companies, industries, and regions that are expected to be most affected by the new standard. So moving on to the webcast then, just a few comments about how this will run. First, if you'd like to download the slide pack, then there's a button to do that right below the window on your screen that's showing the slides. In the second half of this session, we'll be taking questions. So if you have a question that you'd like to submit, then there's a text box on your screen to do that. Just type your question and click on submit, and it will come through to us. A recording of the webcast will be available after we finished, and there's a link to where you can access that recording on slide 2. And finally, just to note that, as always, the views expressed during this webcast are those of myself and the other presenters. They are not necessarily the views of the IASB or the IASB IFRS Foundation. So with that, I'll hand over to Catherine to introduce IFRS 16.
Thanks, Petrina. So we'll start this afternoon with an overview of why the IASB made the decision to change lessee accounting. We've talked about this in quite some detail in our project updates over the last year, so I'll plan to keep this part quite brief. We'll then spend a few slides summarising what has changed in IFRS 16 compared to previous accounting under IAS 17. We'll concentrate on the biggest changes, most notably those to the primary financial statements of lessees. We'll also talk about the effect of IFRS 16 on a lessee's performance metrics. Finally, we'll talk briefly about the effective date of IFRS 16 and about the transition requirements. We're planning to talk through the slide pack for no longer than about 20 minutes to leave plenty of time for questions at the end. Starting with slide 4 then, which summarises why the IASB think it's necessary to change lessee accounting. So the IASB believes that leases provide an important source of financing and that lessees obtain assets and incur liabilities when they enter into leases. That's a view that's shared by a lot of the people that provided feedback to us throughout the course of the project. Most investors and analysts told us that, in their view, leases create debt-like obligations for a lessee. Contrary to that, though, most leases are off balance sheet today under IAS 17. Throughout the project, we've performed research about the problems that exist today in lease accounting and about the financial effect of those problems. There's a lot of detail about that research in the effects analysis that Petrina mentioned earlier and which is now available on our website. One of the things we found was that over 85% by value of today's lease liabilities are not reported on company balance sheets because they're classified as operating leases. So that means that a significant amount of the debt-like liabilities that investors consider to be created by leases are currently missing from company balance sheets. Because of this, investors and analysts face several difficulties today when they try to understand information reported by lessees. First of all, they struggle to get an accurate picture of lease assets and liabilities because those amounts do not appear on the balance sheet for operating leases. Secondly, they find it difficult to compare companies that lease assets with those that buy similar assets. And again, that's mainly because assets and liabilities arising from today's operating leases do not appear on the balance sheet. Finally, investors and analysts don't have enough information today to reasonably estimate the amount of off-balance sheet lease obligations. We understand that some investors currently make rough estimates, and in many of these cases, they're actually overestimating the amount of lease obligations that exist today. Because of these problems with information reported about leases under IAS 17, the IASB decided to make a number of changes to lessee accounting, and these are summarised on slide 5. First, I should mention that IFRS 16 substantially retains the existing accounting requirements for lessors. That's because the feedback we've had demonstrates that the costs of making any substantial change to lessor accounting would outweigh the benefits at the moment. The same is not true, however, for lessee accounting, where the IASB has concluded that addressing the problems with today's reporting is worth the cost of making those changes. Therefore, IFRS 16 requires a lessee to bring all leases onto the balance sheet with a couple of limited exceptions. In other words, lessees will now be required to account for all of their leases similarly to today's finance leases. We'll talk about the effect of this on the financial statements over the next few slides. In summary, though, bringing all leases onto the balance sheet is intended to address the difficulties faced by users of financial statements today. It will do that by ensuring companies include properly measured financial liabilities for all leases, thereby addressing concerns that exist today about leverage information. Recognition of lease assets on the balance sheet will enable investors and analysts to compare companies that lease assets with those that purchase similar assets. The other primary financial statements will also be affected by IFRS 16. Now that assets and liabilities are to be recognised for all leases, rental costs previously recognised for operating leases under IAS 17 will effectively be replaced by depreciation on the leased asset and interest on the lease liability. Compared to reporting under IAS 17, this will affect both the income statement and the cash flow statement by increasing financing costs and cash flows and by decreasing operating expenses and cash flows. So I'll now hand over to you, Roberta, for a bit more detail about the effects of IFRS 16 on the primary financial statements.
Thank you, Catherine. First, I will talk about the balance sheet, which is covered on slides 6 and 7. Slide 6 summarizes what is included in the recognition and measurement of lease liabilities, and slide 7 summarizes what is excluded. Just to note also that the measurement of lease assets is based on the measurement of the lease liability, with a few adjustments where relevant. The general principle applied under IFRS 16 is that the amount of the lease liability should reflect those payments that are economically unavoidable for the lessee. This means that several sorts of payments are included in the lease liability. Firstly, all fixed payments are included. Fixed payments are all those that are unavoidable by the lessee. These include, for example, any inflation-linked payments, because these are unavoidable and do not depend on any future activity of the lessee. Secondly, the lease liability also includes any optional payments if the lessee is reasonably certain to make these payments. This might include payments related to extension or termination options, or termination penalties if the lease term reflects an option to terminate the lease. The reasonably certain threshold in IFRS 16 is the same as that used in IAS 17 today. And finally, the lease liability also includes amounts expected to be paid under residual value guarantees. Again, this is because these payments cannot be avoided by a lessee. Moving to slide 7, in terms of what is not included on the balance sheet. First, IFRS 16 includes two optional recognition exemptions relating to leases of less than 12 months and leases for which the underlying asset is of low value. The ISP decided to include these exemptions because for these leases, the ISP didn't think that the benefit of recognizing assets and liabilities on the balance sheet outweighed the cost of including them. This is essentially because entities often have very high volumes of these leases, but the assets and liabilities arising from them are often immaterial. In addition, the lease liability does not include the variable lease payments linked to future use of the lease asset or to sales arising from the use of the lease asset. This is partially for cost-benefit reasons, but also because many consider these payments to be avoidable by the lessee. This is similar to IAS 17 today, where contingent rentals are not included in the minimum lease payments. And finally, the lease liability also excludes any optional payments that the LSE is not reasonably certain to make. Again, this is the same threshold as is used today in IAS 17. Moving on to LSE's income statement, as Catherine mentioned earlier, IFRS 16 will result in a decrease in operating expenses and in an increase in finance cost. This is because the previous rental expenses for operating leases will now be replaced by a depreciation charge on the lease asset and interest on the lease liability. Consistent with interest charge on other financial liabilities, interest relating to a lease will decrease over the life of the lease as lease payments are made. Depreciation charges will be recognized similarly to those on other non-current assets and will typically be recognized on a straight line basis. This means that for an individual lease, the overall income statement expense will be higher in the early years of a lease and lower in the later years. This is different to today's operating leases, for which rent is generally recognized on a straight line basis. However, as we describe in detail in the effect analysis that we published today, the net effect of IFRS 16 on the income statement is expected to be minimal for many lessees that have a portfolio of leases starting and ending in different reporting periods. Slide 9 summarizes the effect of IFRS 16 for lessees on some key ratios that are often used by analysts to analyze performance. Firstly, IFRS 16 will give rise to an increase in leverage for all entities that have operating leases today. This is because of the recognition of lease liabilities on the balance sheet, which weren't there before. And similarly, these entities will also see a decrease in asset turnover ratios, because assets relating to former operating leases will be recognized on the balance sheet for the first time. Applying IFRS 16 will mean that these ratios become much more comparable between entities that lease assets and entities that purchase similar assets. IFRS 16 will also affect profit measures, most notably profit measures such as operating profit, EBIT, and EBITDA will be higher under IFRS 16. This is because the interest previously embedded in operating rental expenses will become finance cost under the new requirements. The last thing we are going to cover before moving on to questions is the effective date and the transition requirements for IFRS 16. Catherine, could you please summarize for us?
Yes, of course. So we've summarized these topics on slide 10. where you can see that the effective date of IFRS 16 will be the 1st of January 2019. That means that entities will be required to apply the new standard to annual periods beginning on or after that date. Early application is permitted, but only for those entities that also apply the new revenue standard, IFRS 15. And that's because there's quite a lot of interaction between leases and revenue, particularly in areas such as sale and leaseback transactions. So it would be difficult to apply some of the new leases requirements without also applying IFRS 15. Moving on to transition then, the IASB took a fairly pragmatic approach here after listening to a lot of feedback from preparers about the challenges they expect when first implementing IFRS 16. Entities are permitted to perform a fully retrospective transition approach if they want to, but IFRS 16 also permits an entity to choose to apply a cumulative catch-up transition method, which is similar in principle to that permitted on initial application of IFRS 15. If an entity does elect this option, then there's a number of pretty significant transition reliefs. Most notably, such an entity would not need to restate any of its comparative figures in the year of initial application, and it would also not need to apply IFRS 16 to any leases that end within 12 months. The cumulative catch-up method also permits a simplified measurement approach for lease assets on transition, which is expected to provide a lot of relief for entities with high volumes of leases. The IASB concluded that the cost benefit for preparers of permitting these reliefs justified their financial reporting consequences in the year of initial application. However, the transition requirements in IFRS 16 do include some extra disclosure requirements to help explain the effects on the financial statements of an entity applying the cumulative catch-up method. Finally, slide 11 provides links to some sources of further information relating to IFRS 16. The slide includes a link to the effects analysis, which we've referred to a few times this afternoon. So with that, we'll move on to looking at some of the questions we've received during the webcast. Petrina, I think you've been keeping an eye on these.
Yes, Catherine, thank you. And indeed, we have had quite a few questions already, and they keep coming in. So I doubt that we'll have time to get through them all, but let's get moving and see how far we can get. First of all, I think the topic that has received most questions so far are around the recognition exemptions, both the short-term lease exemption, but also actually most the most popular questions are around the low-value asset lease exemption and really asking, does IFRS 16 define what a low-value asset is or what does it say about it? So maybe, Catherine, could you take that?
Yes. So I'll start by talking about the short-term exemption. And I think the questions we've had here are mostly focused on how exactly that is defined. So the exemption is defined as any lease with a term of less than 12 months could take that exemption. Now, in terms of what exactly that 12 months means, it's sort of defined and measured in the same way as lease term is defined within IFRS 16. So what that means, for example, is if there was a lease with an extension option, if that option was reasonably certain to go ahead, then that would be included in the assessment of lease term and therefore included in the measurement of whether or not the lease is shorter or longer than 12 months. So in summary, a short-term lease, anything less than 12 months in terms of lease term as defined in the standard. Onto the exemption for leases of low value assets, which we have had a lot of questions on. So firstly, just to explain what that exemption is all about. We had a lot of feedback during the course of the project to the effect that there's a subset of assets, if you like, which are generally leased in very high volumes but tend to be low in value per individual asset and generally for most companies would not be material. And a lot of stakeholders felt that for those leases in particular, the costs of applying IFRS 16 would perhaps outweigh the reporting benefits, because ultimately the reporting in most of these cases would not be that material. So we had a lot of that feedback. So the IASB considered whether they could introduce an exemption to help ease the cost burden there, and that's how they got to the decision to introduce an optional exemption for these leases of low-value assets. Now, having made that decision, there was then a lot of debate had by the IASB, and they did a lot of outreach on this topic about how exactly a low-value asset should be defined, because that is quite a difficult thing to define in an operational way. So we spoke to quite a lot of different companies about the kind of assets that might qualify, and to work out what would be the most useful way to define that exemption. So it is stated in the standard as assets that are low value, and there is then some discussion about the nature of those assets. And so to give some example, it's things like small office equipment or desktop computers, things that generally you get a lot of volume of, but that's in value terms they're not significant. And the standard does include some detailed application guidance, and also a quite detailed illustrative example, which we hope will be very helpful in allowing entities to make judgments around what satisfies the definition of low value. We've also had some questions about the existence of a quantitative threshold on this low-value definition, and about the fact that the basis for conclusions to IFRS 16 does contain some discussion about the fact that the IASB had in mind, when having the discussions about the low-value asset exemption, leases of assets with a value when new of around the region of $5,000 in value. Now, that does appear in the basis for conclusions rather than the standard. And the reason that it exists is because we had a lot of feedback that would help to make the exemption more operational for companies if they had something to work with in terms of exactly what the IASB had in mind. However, it can't be strictly absolute. For example, things like inflation and the potential for new types of assets that have never been considered before appearing in future years mean that any number that was on the table now might be different in a few years' time. So it is in the basis for conclusions only, rather than being an absolute threshold, but it exists to give companies an idea of exactly what sort of things that the IASB had in mind when they discussed the exemption in 2015. Finally, I'll just mention a couple of things that relate to both exemptions, both short-term and low-value assets. Firstly, in both cases, if the exemption is taken, the lease would be accounted for like today's operating leases, i.e. IFRS 16, in terms of putting that lease on the balance sheet, would not need to be applied. And in both cases, where the exemption is taken, the amount of expense in the income statement relating to those exempt leases is one of the disclosure requirements of the standard.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Catherine. The next topic I'm going to move to is actually some questions around measurements. We have a number of questions in this area, a few on the discount rate. So absolutely, the amounts that are recognised on the balance sheet are discounted amounts, the discounted amount of lease payments, and a few people asking about the discount rate that's to be used. Also, some questions on inflation-linked payments, and potentially whether people have to start to project out what the expected future inflation will be, and also, if not, what happens on reassessment there. So maybe, Roberta, could you pick up both discount rate as well as inflation-linked payments?
Yeah, sure. So starting with discount rate, to calculate the present value of future lease payments, LSE should use a discount rate that reflects how the contract is priced. So IFRS 16 requires LSE to use the interest rate that is implicit in the lease. If the interest rate implicit in the lease is not readily determinable by the lessee, the lessee should use its incremental borrowing rate. but the incremental borrowing rate should take into account the terms and condition of the specific lease, like the length of the lease, the nature and the quality of the collateral provided, as well as the economic environment in which the leasing transaction occurs. And on the second topic, Petrina, you mentioned, was about inflation-linked payments. So, as mentioned during the presentation, inflation-linked payments are included as part of lease liabilities. However, they are measured in a simplified way. The measurement is based on the current contractual payments at the inception of the contract. So a company does not need to forecast any future inflation. So what happens if there is a change in the contractual payments following a change in inflation? Well, in this case, LSE should remeasure the lease liability based on the updated cash flows. A company will reassess lease assets and lease liabilities only when it already knows the actual change in the contractual lease payment.
Thank you, Roberta. Moving on to another topic we've had a few questions on is around the definition of a lease. And I think those listeners that have been following the project might have been surprised that we didn't touch on the definition in our presentation. So maybe, Catherine, could I hand over to you? Maybe you could tell us what IFRS 16 says about the definition.
Yes. So in terms of the definition of a lease, IFRS 16 essentially says that this is based on whether a contract conveys the right to control the use of an identified asset for a period of time in exchange for consideration. And if it does, then that contract is considered to contain a lease. Just to talk about also how that compares to the definition of a lease that was in place under IAS 17 and IFRIC 4. IFRS 16 does provide quite a bit more detailed requirements and guidance and examples in this area than the previous standard did. And that's because with all leases coming on balance sheet, the distinction between a lease and a service is much more important than it used to be, because previously operating leases and services were accounted for very similarly. Having said that, however, the IASB do think that in the vast majority of cases, it is going to be clear whether a contract is a lease or whether it's a service. That was true under IAS 17, and it continues to be true under IFRS 16. There will be a minority of cases where the distinction is a bit more difficult to judge. And in those cases, we think that the additional requirements, guidance and examples in IFRS 16 are going to be helpful in making that judgment. And we have looked at what the practical differences in outcomes are going to be, comparing the new and old definition guidance. In doing that, we identified one or two scenarios that would result in a lease conclusion under IAS 17, but that will result in a service under the new requirements. And we didn't identify any scenarios for which the reverse of that is expected to be true. So in practical terms, we expect that the differences between IAS 17 and IFRS 16 in this area are expected to be quite narrow. The final thing I will mention on definition, because I know we've had a few questions on it, is about whether, given that a difference does exist, although in practicality it's expected to not occur that often, whether there's a requirement for companies to reconsider all of their contracts when they first adopt IFRS 16 as to whether they're a lease or not. So to clarify on that, an entity isn't required to reassess its existing contracts on initial application in terms of whether or not those contracts are leases. And that's because IFRS 16 does include an option within the transition requirements to retain the existing assessment of whether or not a contract contains a lease. So that means an entity can assume on transition that its existing leases continue to be leases, and that its existing services continue to be services, and transition its contracts onto IFRS 16 on that basis by applying the new requirements to all existing leases. And if an entity does do that, then the new definition requirements would then be applied only to new contracts that it enters into after initial application of IFRS 16.
Thank you, Catherine. I'm just going to pick up around another question, by the way. I'm just going to pick up another measurement question. And actually, I suppose it's linked to something you mentioned earlier, Catherine, on short-term leases. The short-term lease definition of being 12 months or less is based on the lease term being less than 12 months. And there's just been a couple of questions about, well, what is the lease term and how do you work it out? Well, the lease term and how you work it out, actually, we've retained there a reasonably certain threshold, similar to what's in IAS 17 today. So effectively, the lease term will be the non-cancellable period of a lease, but it will also include any optional periods, any extension periods, to the extent that the lessee is reasonably certain to extend the lease. And so that concept is also, and so by the way, as I say, for those of you familiar with IAS 17, that's a familiar threshold. The difference will be that IAS 17 today really only uses those two words and doesn't give you anything else. IFRS 16, you will see, has quite a lot of application guidance included to really help people work out when a lessee would be reasonably certain to exercise. So as I say, that's how you work out the lease term for any lease. It's also how you work out the lease term of a short-term lease. And there have been a couple of questions, I suppose, asking maybe with the idea that, oh, could I make some of my leases less than 12 months and then I wouldn't have to recognize those? You know, and potentially what happens if I exercise an option on a short-term lease? Well, what happens there is actually in the guidance it would say if something has initially qualified as a short-term lease, if the lessee ends up extending that lease term, for example, by exercising an extension option or not exercising a break clause, then the standard would require you to relook at that lease again, to relook at it to say, is it still a short-term lease, or in fact, do I think that this now becomes a lease that should be recognised on the balance sheet? I'm now going to move on to another topic, again picked up, that we haven't mentioned so far, which is subleases. And Roberta, I'm just looking at you. A few people have, of course, picked up the fact that lessee accounting is changing, but lessor accounting isn't under IFRS 16. And so maybe you could just briefly explain what does IFRS 16 say about subleases.
Sure. In a sublease, basically a company that is usually known as an intermediate lessor acts at the same time as a lessee and as a lessor for the same underlying asset. IFRS 16 requires an intermediate lessor to account for the head lease and the sublease as two separate contracts, applying both the lessee and the lessor accounting requirements. From a practical point of view, for the head lease, an intermediate lessor applies the lessee accounting requirements, and so it recognizes the right of use asset and the lease liability on its balance sheet. For the sublease, the intermediate lessor applies the lessor accounting requirements, and so the sublease could be either a finance lease or an operating lease. But when classifying the sublease, the intermediate lessor should evaluate the lease by reference to the right of use asset that arises from the head lease and not by reference to the underlying asset. Just to mention, because we had some questions about the practical implication on the balance sheet and on the income statement of the differences between the C and lessor accounting, a couple of examples illustrating how IFRS 16 requirements work for subleases are included in the package of documents that the ISB published today.
Thank you, Roberta. I'm going to pick up, again, a number of questions about IFRS 16 versus the forthcoming FASB standard, because, of course, this project has been a joint project between the ISB and the FASB. The first thing to say is that the FASB has not yet published its new leases standard. It certainly expects to soon and early in 2016, so soon there should be a new FASB standard on leases. The other question that has arisen is some people have asked, well, are they the same or what are the differences between the standard? In terms of that, of course, because the project was a joint project, then in many important respects, IFRS 16 and the new US standard are expected to be similar. Most notably and probably most importantly, both IFRS 16 and the new US standard will require assets and liabilities to be recognized on the balance sheets of lessees for all leases with some exceptions. Also, the requirements for the definition of a lease are expected to be the same. And also lease liabilities will be measured very similarly. And finally, and also importantly, the new US standard will also substantially retain existing lessor accounting, as does IFRS 16, because IFRS 16 also substantially retains existing lessor accounting. However, the two standards won't be completely aligned. The main difference that arises between IFRS 16 and the US standard is in terms of how lease expenses flow through the income statement and how cash flows will flow through the cash flow statement. The FASB has decided to retain a dual model for lessees, so whilst all leases will be recognised on the balance sheet in terms of the income statement and cash flow statement, they'll still under US GAAP, you'll still distinguish between finance and operating leases in a similar way to how that's done today. And then what happens is that effectively in the income statement, the US standard will then retain a typically straight-line single expense for former operating leases, which is, of course, different to what will happen under IFRS 16, where you'll separate that single amount into amount of depreciation on the asset and interest on the lease liability. Now, there are a few other differences between the two standards that are really a direct consequence of these different lessee accounting models for lessee, and essentially those differences relate to subleases, to some pieces of sale and lease back accounting, and also to disclosure and transition. And finally, the FASB has also decided not to include a recognition exemption for leases of low-value assets, which has been included in IFRS 16. Also, we've mentioned the effects analysis already today, and if you're interested in any more detail about the expected differences between the two standards, then there is quite some detail on those expected or the expected effects of any differences there within the effects analysis. Okay, moving on, transition has been a popular topic, and I think some people, we in our transition requirements, Catherine, a number of people noticed that we talked about a cumulative catch-up transition method. Maybe you could explain that a bit more. Also, a couple of people asked, we referred to a simplified measurement of right-of-use assets. Maybe you could explain that. And the final point was somebody was just wanted to clarify, is a fully retrospective approach still available as an option?
Yes. Okay, I'll actually start with the last question there because that's a very short one to answer. So, yes, if a company would like to perform a fully retrospective transition approach, then that option exists. And they would either apply a fully retrospective approach to all of their leases or apply the alternative to all of their leases. So in terms of that alternative, which I referred to earlier as the cumulative catch-up transition method, the questions about how exactly that works, to summarise, what would be done under that method is that instead of restating comparative figures, a company would on the first day of the accounting period in which IFRS 16 is first applied, they would measure all of their assets and liabilities in accordance with IFRS 16, but instead of effectively going back in time for reporting purposes and restating comparatives, they would post the effect of that measurement as an adjustment through retained earnings on the first day of that accounting period during which the standard is adopted. So that's an approach that's similar to what is permitted in IFRS 15, and it does introduce some sort of practical savings in the sense that the comparatives don't need to be restated and it can just be a day one adjustment. So then on to the questions about the simplified measurement approach, which I touched on briefly during the slides. As I said, there are a number of fairly substantial transition reliefs available if the cumulative catch-up method is adopted. And one of those is that the IASB has decided to permit a choice as to how to measure the right of use asset on day one of that accounting period. So the non-simplified method, if you like, is to measure it as if IFRS 16 had always been applied, and that would require the use of a certain amount of historical information about leases. And the feedback that we had was that there would be an amount of cost associated with that, which for leases that are perhaps high in volume, low in value, that cost wouldn't necessarily be worthwhile. So there is an alternative that can be selected for leases to which an entity chooses to apply it, and that is that the right of use asset on transition can be measured as being equal to the lease liability. Now that is significantly easier to do because it requires much less information. The downside is of course that the number is less accurate, if you like, and we have worked through what the potential consequences of adopting this simplified approach is. And in all cases, it would mean that the asset would be slightly higher on transition than if it were measured correctly, so to speak, in accordance with the standard, and therefore that for the remainder of the lease, the depreciation charge would be a little higher than it would be if a more accurate transition method were adopted in terms of measuring the right of use asset. So that choice has been offered on a lease-by-lease basis rather than all or none. And the reason for that is that it will allow entities to make a call as to, you know, for their significant leases for which getting to the right right of use asset on transition and the right depreciation going forward will be worth the costs of getting that backward-looking information. But for those cases where you have, say, leases that are immaterial to that particular set of financial statements, it might be that any potential impact of a simplified approach is insignificant, and in those cases an entity would be able to choose to take the simplified option. So it is there to permit an entity to judge which of its leases are significant enough to warrant that bit more cost. And a slightly more accurate measurement.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Catherine. A couple of questions now picking up on our use of and on our reference to depreciation. The questions coming out of that are some people saying, well, if I haven't bought this asset, how is it depreciation in a sense? And some others then, I suppose, which is linked to this, is thinking about the presentation of this lease asset, what we call a right of use asset, and a few questions about is it tangible, is it intangible, where does it get presented. So to cover all of that off, I would say that what IFRS 16 says is, first of all, the way you account for a right of use asset is really very similar to how you account for items of PP&E. So whilst you look into IFRS 16, not IAS 16, in terms of how you account for a right of use asset, what IFRS 16 does is it says that when you are depreciating that right of use asset, we essentially send you to IAS 16 and say, look, you'll depreciate this on a very similar basis to how you do items of property, plant and equipment. And really, by the way, the reason we think it makes sense to account for these in a very similar way is because the economic benefits, essentially, that a lessee can derive from using leased assets are very similar to the economic benefits that it can derive from an asset that it owns. Very often, you're using leased assets in exactly the same way as you're using owned assets. That sort of flows through in terms of where you present
the right-of-use asset. What we say there is that clearly if it were significant enough to your business, you could certainly present those right-of-use assets as their own line item. They'd be considered to be a non-current, non-financial asset. Again, similar to PP&E. So they could be their own line item. Alternatively, if not presented as their own line item on the balance sheet, you would present right-of-use assets together and as part of property, plant and equipment, and then simply provide a note disclosure that breaks out the carrying amount of those right-of-use assets separately from items of property, plant and equipment. We're coming close to the end, but I'm just going to pick up on something else that has been asked a number of times, which is a number of people have asked whether there will be or whether we're planning to have a transition resource group for leases. Because, of course, again, those of you familiar with what we do will have noted that there has been such a group on the more recent revenue standard, and also there was an implementation group set up for IFRS 9 and specifically the impairment requirements. So the answer to that is, in short, no. The ISB does not think it's necessary in the context of leases, and indeed we actually sought the advice of the Advisory Council last year in reaching this conclusion, where our Advisory Council members agreed that a transition resource group would not be needed for leases. Ultimately, what IFRS 16 is really doing is that it's increasing the population of contracts to which today's finance lease accounting is applied. So although the amounts reported by many companies will actually change and possibly change substantially, the actual accounting treatment in IFRS 16 is already familiar to preparers and users of financial statements and others. And this was different from the new revenue standard that really brought in new principles for revenue recognition that were different from any previous revenue requirements. And this was also the case for IFRS 9, where an implementation group was set up relating to the new impairment requirements, because that standard really introduced a very new way of accounting for loan loss provisions. So in summary, the ISB really doesn't see that the same need exists in the context of IFRS 16. In saying that, of course, we do intend to be active in monitoring and supporting implementation. Maybe the final question, I'm afraid, we can take given the time is that there have been a number of questions on the IFRS for SMEs and what's the effect for anybody applying IFRS for SMEs. In short, this does not affect IFRS for SMEs. IFRS 16 is just to be applied by those that are required to apply full IFRS. We have addressed the effect or the consequences for SMEs in our effects analysis. So to the extent you're interested in any more information about IFRS for SMEs or SMEs, small and medium-sized entities more generally, then we'd encourage you to look at the effects analysis. So maybe with that, I'm afraid we have run out of time on this webcast. I'd like to thank you for listening and certainly also for your active participation in submitting so many questions. We hope that you found the webcast useful. And for more information on IFRS 16, of course, please go to our website. Thank you.